but I put out the book review today.
Blog Talk Radio.
Here we go.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up the world, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Gain new knowledge, get a fresh new start. They never will bring you there. So let's talk about it when life and on the air.
Good morning, everyone, from rainy Upper Westchester. It's rainy, it's cool, but this is going to be a really hot show, and this is going to be fantastic. We have the author, one of the authors of Murder in Montague Falls, and let me give you a little hint about the book. There are three stories present. All three stories present real-life issues that we hope teens never encounter, but will learn from the mistakes shared in these fantastic five-star novellas. Characters that have both strengths and flaws, and stories that can be used for teen discussion groups, parent education, and behavior management. Enter Montague Falls at your own risk. Ha ha. And we have, yeah, that's me for today. And we have, I'm going to say this right, Russ Cole Chimiro, one of the authors here. The other two are Shawnee Hatton and Patrick Thomas. And maybe when they write, I hope, another one, they'll all come on. And the cover of this book is Gary, let me tell you. So, good morning, and we've finally made it since January. But this book is really good. It was interesting. Each story is different. So what inspired you to put this collection together?
So there's a little bit of a tale to this.
Okay.
So my story, Red Ink, is based on, it's about a paperboy back in the 1980s who kind of gets mixed up into this murder mystery. So I was a paperboy. So Isaac, the lead character, is based entirely on me and my experience back then. So to this day, my birthday's in 2 weeks. I'll be 49. So I've worked a lot of jobs over 37 years. To this day, being a paperboy, this is back when you were allowed to do that because you can't do it nowadays. It's still my favorite job I've ever had. You know, I was, 13, 14 years old, and I – was out on my own, and I had my own money, and I had a job, and it was great. And I came across various characters along the way, and it always stuck with me. And then about 20 years ago, it was just sort of one of those, bolt of lightning moments where in my mind's eye, I saw my slightly younger self running down a street at night. And it was sort of like in a movie where you only see from the knees down to the feet, just running and huffing and puffing, running from something. And I don't know, I can't really tell you how or why I merged the two together, but I kind of knew that was my paperboy self. And then suddenly this idea kind of popped into my head about what this mystery would be. And I wanted to write this story for a long time. And my intention originally was to write it as a novel. But as I thought about it, I wasn't entirely clear that there was enough story there for 90,000 words. Mm. And ultimately I said, there's too much story for a short story and not quite enough for a novel. So a novella felt like the right venue for it. But I wanted to do a project with some other of my writer buddies. So so Sawney, which is actually a pen name, he and I actually went to high school together.
Mm.
And we were, even back then, we were always talking books and movies, and we both of us wanted to be screenwriters and directors. Sawney actually did some screenwriting at one point out in L.A., but we lost touch with each other after high school. we hadn't seen each other for, the better part of 25 years. And for no particular reason. We just kind of went our separate ways. He reached out to me about 7 or 8 years ago, something like that. He found me on Facebook and he said, hey, I've been sort of following you from afar because I've had a book out about 10 years ago called Finders Keepers. It's like, oh, I've been following what you've been doing, and we reconnected, and we kind of picked up right where we left off. And he's a writer. He does, you know, he writes more darker stuff than I do generally, but we've done a bunch of show conventions together, and he reads all my stuff, almost all my stuff, and gives me notes. I read almost all his stuff, and I give him notes. And I was looking for a project to do together, and I invited him to do this book with me. And his story, The Devil's Delinquents, he actually originally wrote as a screenplay.
Oh, nice.
So it was already kind of fairly fleshed out by the time I invited him, and he said, oh, I have the perfect thing that I want to translate back into this novella. And then Patrick Thomas, I met him about, 10 years ago out on book tour, because obviously right now we can't go out and do live conventions, but we will again. And, you know, I'm sort of what you call a table warrior. You know, I go out and I do as many conventions as I can. I love working at the book. I love selling books. I love talking to people. That's just my personality. And Pat's the same way. So we've been friends a long time, and we've done some other projects together. And I said, hey, and I know he writes various so I write mostly science fiction and fantasy, but I love crime, and I'm moving more into the crime space. And I said to Pat, I said, hey, I'm doing this project. Do you want to come in? And he said, yeah, that's great. So that's kind of how the three of us kind of pulled it all together.
That was interesting. So tell us a little bit about their stories. You know, sometimes I read books by Vincent Zandri. I don't know if you've read Vincent Zandri. He's more on your line of writing. And
okay,
I told him yesterday his stories give me nightmares. Seriously, that's how he knows that he succeeded with scaring me and everybody else. And all the characters are so off the wall that you have no idea what they're going to do or anything. So it's scary. So tell us a little bit about the second story, The Devil's Delinquent, and then the last one, A Many Splendid Thing. And I'm an educator, and I go like, what?
So the Devil's Delinquent. Yeah. So if you recall back, and so Sawney and I, we grew up on Long Island, and we went to high school in the 80s. And then if you recall a little bit past that, it was in the early 90s, there was this stretch of time in American history. There was sort of the Satanic Panic era. And there were three boys, you may know the story of the West Memphis Three, where these three teenagers were accused of a brutal murder out in, I want to say it was Kentucky, out in Memphis, where they were sort of dabbling with satanic rituals, and they killed this kid. And that was kind of like the genesis for Sawney. And then he noticed that there was some similarities between – it was also in Northport on Long Island. There was another murder that kind of took place along with these sort of satanic rituals. And what struck him was that these teenagers who, you know, they weren't – up until that point, you wouldn't have said, oh, my God, these are going to be satanic murderers. But they weren't necessarily – they weren't the brightest bulbs. Maybe not the dumbest, but they weren't the brightest bulbs. And then in each case, there was sort of a ringleader who kind of recruited the other two. It's not like they said, oh, hey, let's go kill someone. It was sort of come into my fold. Let's dabble a little bit. And they ultimately found themselves committing these very heinous acts, which would seem on the surface utterly incomprehensible. Why would any rational person do something so horrible? You know, you don't just wake up one day and say, oh, I think I'm going to take someone out into the woods and kill them, unless something's truly wrong with you. So he was sort of interested in, well, how does three, you know, let's call them more or less ordinary people, how do they get involved in this kind of madness? So that's kind of what drew him into this kind of story. And in The Devil's Delinquents, there's three teens. There's Natalie, there's Derry, and there's Cal. And Natalie is sort of the femme fatale of the group, and she sort of brings them into her inner sanctum by, you know, she's sort of like the dark and dangerous one, and of course she's mysterious,
yeah.
And they're teenagers, and you know, the dark mysterious girl, and they kind of both kind of have a crush on her, and she kind of pulls them into her world, not realizing at first, you know, they think it's just like, oh, we'll do, you know, it's almost like playing a Ouija board on steroids. You don't think it's a real thing, you know, hey,
yeah.
you know, Black Sabbath, and we'll listen to, you know, heavy metal music, and it's cool. But they don't think of it beyond that. But slowly but surely, they start going deeper and deeper and deeper into this world, and ultimately, they do some pretty terrible things.
Yeah, I know they do. And a lot of teens today, unfortunately, might get roped into doing a whole bunch of things when they don't really think. So tell us about the last story. Where there is, I have the background,
yes.
A teacher that convinces
yes.
one of her students to get rid of her husband.
Right. So it's actually, it's a sort of a classic, this is more classic noir, right? This is setback. So whereas my story is set in the 80s, Sony's is in the 90s, but this one is set back in the 50s. So obviously the culture was different. Times were different. The way adults dealt with teenagers and children was far different. And the premise is that a sultry high school teacher seduces one of her students in the hopes that she will murder her husband. And, you know, if you go back to, there was a movie in the 90s with Nicole Kidman, To Die For, which kind of has the same kind of theme. You know, the postman always rings twice. You know, this is sort of at a time when, you know, back in the 50s, if you were a teenager, parents didn't really, you know, back then, the teachers really were, they were thought of much differently than now. And I was a teacher, I was an English teacher myself. I was in the school system, so I know exactly what that's like. The walls were broken down. You know, it used to be that, you know, if your teacher said something, that was the law. That was it. Your parents 100% would side with the teachers and the school, and there was no ifs, ands, or buts about it. You know, today, if you don't tell your student that he or she is perfect, then your parents are suing you. It's just ridiculous the way our society has gone. But back then in Pat's story, you know, you've got this teenager who is sort of – his parents have split up. His dad is, you know, like so many people, kind of fell into a bottle a little bit because he's lonely, and his mother hooked up with this kind of real slime ball, and the teenager feels really rejected, and this sultry teacher kind of starts paying attention to him, and of course he's 17 years old or so, and he's very inexperienced, and all of a sudden this beautiful woman and an authority figure is suddenly paying all this attention to him. So of course he's going to be, you know, it's like every teenager's dream. Oh my God, the beautiful teacher has a crush on me. Wow, this is my fantasy come true. Well, not all, you know, sometimes a fantasy turns into a nightmare. You know, he doesn't realize that this woman has her own very dark past, and she has her own, she doesn't know, he doesn't know at first that this teacher wants him to do this terrible thing. She, you know, Rosa, the teacher, starts bringing him in, but she pulls him into her world with attention and sex, and this teenager is very, of course, he's captivated. He's fallen under her spell. I mean, it's not just a teacher. She's this beautiful, sultry woman who, if he's 17 and she's only 25, the difference in age is not that different. I mean, I remember when I did my student teaching in Buffalo, New York, when I was 22, 23, and my students were 16, 17 years old, I had students who hit on me, and it was really weird. And this is 20 years ago, 25 years ago, and even then it was really strange, and it was a little unclear how to handle that. If you go back 30 years before that, the lines were really blurry, and, you know, no one really listened to you. So this kid really kind of got sucked into her world, and she used manipulation and jealousy, and she would threaten to cut off her love and her sexual advances on him to the point where he kind of just ultimately is completely under her spell.
That's scary. Well, I have to tell you, I taught in a tough school in the Bronx for a lot of years, and I'm little. And I walked into a room, and trust me, I was the law. They didn't mention this girl. It all depended on how you said it. And they learned that I started teaching when I was 18. I graduated college in 3 years. I was too super smart. And yeah, so my first class was when I was 19 years old, just yesterday. And I taught the toughest sixth grade in the entire school. And it took me about a month to realize, brilliant one, you're in charge. You got them. And I said to them, well, you know, it's okay because you won't graduate and you get to look at me next year. That's, I didn't have to say anything after that. And a whole bunch of other stuff. Yeah, they were. Yep. It was a tough school, but you know what? You had exactly, people hit on people. They did. Teachers had affairs with teachers, whatever. Yeah. But, you know, it's different now. You have to watch what you say. You can't give the same type of assignments. And if you criticize, you get in trouble.
No. Yeah, I remember. I'll never forget this moment as long as I live. I was one of the ways that I would teach is that I'm very animated. I mean, even right now, I'm walking around in my basement. I was reading. I can't remember what the assignment was. I think it was Shakespeare, but I don't recall. So I walk up and down the rows just to kind of keep the students engaged, and you know, it would force them to kind of focus. And I was standing up. I was in the back of the room, closer to the windows, and I was reading from a book, and I had my hands up so that my chest was a little bit, you know, exposed. And I was reading, and I stopped for a second, and I said, what is – and I felt something, and I looked down, and this teenage girl was literally rubbing my belly.
Oh, God.
I'm like, what is happening right now? No,
they wouldn't even think that. I think the worst thing ever said to me, and it was hilarious, and I did it on purpose – I wanted to see how observant my students, my girls were, and I put on one brown boot and one beige boot one day, and I wanted to see how long it would take them to realize that I was mismatched. And they looked at me and they go, you're usually perfect. I said, no, I'm still perfect. I wanted to see if you could realize that I was, you know, mismatched today. I want to see how your observation skills are today as we go on a trip. You ever take 150 kids on a New York subway? It was fun.
Oh, geez.
And they
listen. Actually,
yeah, they listen. Yeah. They listen. They actually listen. So
this is
the fun part.
Yeah.
The
story
is Yeah. It was an experience that nobody would have but us. Yeah, we did it.
Yeah.
I don't know how I did it, but I did it.
One of my favorite. So, I'll leave it with one last story from the teaching, and we can get back to the stories. So I was in Buffalo. This was, 93, 92, I can't remember exactly. And I was out. Mm-hmm. I was doing my student teaching, and it was at night. It was like on a Wednesday night, I think, if I recall. Mm-hmm. And I went to this local bar that I would go to with my friends. And I was there, and I was having a beer, and there was music playing, and I was having a good time. And I don't know, it was 9:30, 10 o'clock, something like that. And I'm just having a conversation, and I feel some tap on my shoulder. And at first, I kind of ignore it. And I feel it again, and I'm like, what? And I turn around, and I see one of my students. And she says, Mr. C, what are you doing here? I said, what am I doing here? I said, what are you doing here? I said, you have homework tonight. I said, and I know because I gave it to you. She was with three of her students, other students. They couldn't believe the look on their faces. They got the heck out of there. And the next day in school, they all sat down when I had them in my classroom. Their heads were down. They couldn't look me in the eye. You've never seen four better behaved students for the rest of the term.
Oh yeah, you had them. You had them. Sure, you did.
I had them good.
So how these stories are separate yet distinct, and each other and mine, all of these three fit into the thematic collection. Each of them have teenagers that did something wrong or were wronged. How come you chose that, and why teens? Well, teens get into trouble a lot, I guess.
Well, that's for sure. Well, I wanted to have this collection of novellas. I wanted there to be a theme across the books, and I knew I knew what mine was about. And my protagonist is a teenager, Isaac. He's younger. He's only one about 14 or so. So I want. I decided early on that every story within the collection also needed to have a teen protagonist, and I wanted them all to be in the same town. Now, we kind of all collectively, the three of us, went back and forth about how we wanted to have connective tissue. And some of the ideas, honestly, were terrible. We thought about, oh, maybe it's one of those deals where they all have the same locker, but in at different times. And we went, yeah, you know, it didn't quite work. You know, sometimes you have to go through the bad ideas to get to the good ones. But ultimately, it was more about we decided that we wanted them all to be in the same high school, but at different decades. And that, you know, in my story is the first one, but we reference just a little bit. We reference Red Ink in The Devil's Delinquents. And then in Devil's Delinquents, there's a reference. There's also a reference back to, I think in both one or both stories, there's a reference back to Love is a Many Splendid Thing that happened in the 50s. So there's just that sort of connective texture there. And then in terms of how we came up with Montague Falls, so Sawney and I, in reality, we were kind of, we co-edited the entire collection. He read my story multiple times back and forth. I worked with him on his story back and forth, and we both read Sawney's, Pat's story. And so Sawney and I worked together on even calling the town Montague Falls, because we, since we grew up on Long Island, there were a lot of towns like Patchogue, and we kind of were thinking about of like a lot of, it's what town that has like a first we thought should it be like a Ville type of town, and it didn't quite work. And then we went through, I don't know, 30, 50 iterations until we kind of came on Montague Falls. So that kind of pulled it together. And then thematically, if you look at the cover, you know, there's the road sign. I knew from the beginning that it had to be a road sign. It had to say Montague Falls. It had to be littered with bullet holes and kind of look like very dirty and old. That was from the beginning. But we wanted to have symbols from all three stories on the cover. So you've got the pentagram on the roadside that comes from Sawney's story. And then if you look beneath, you know, there's the newspapers that are bloodied up that come from Red Ink. And then the roses that are right next to them that come from A Splendid Thing. And what was interesting is that we worked with the cover designer, and we went through about 30 or 40 iterations. And if you look on the cover where you have that, those row houses,
I see
suburban row houses, before that, he had put in sort of this, it was more of a dirt road kind of leaning, like a very reedy kind of dirt road leaning kind of down a cliff or falls. But it didn't really work because this is set in a suburban town. So once the aha moment is when he swapped that out and he put in those row houses, it kind of all, it pulled all the themes together, and that's kind of when we knew we had it.
Yeah, I have the cover in front of me, and it's scary, people. And the back cover is just as scary, too. So, question. What would happen if you took Montague Falls and brought it into 2020 or 2021 and had different characters? Yeah. I'm thinking about that. that's my question.
So you say, so if there was a modern-day sequel to it? Or if it was the same stories but written today?
Well, how about, like, different stories but in the same high school but in the present time with teenagers? Just as evil. They're not that much better now.
Oh, I'm definitely not saying that they're better. In fact, you could argue in some ways they're worse.
Yeah, I know.
You know, to write a story today, you almost have to include touches of social media. You know, there's all sorts of cyberbullying, and since the theme of this collection is to have they're all murder mysteries in their own way. Certainly that would have to be one of the themes, whether it was through one story or all of them, for sure. And you probably want to deal with you know, themes of connectivity, the way people interact now. You know, what's interesting is that, so I work in my day job. I work in, I was a journalist. I did my student teaching, but I didn't teach full time. I was a journalist for the first half of my career, and now I do public relations for real estate companies. So, for example, One World Trade Center, so the Freedom Tower. So I worked on that building for many, many years. I was in it when they built it, when they were building it. I was on the 90th floor when there were no walls, right? So, and I had to help them deal with this very, you know, it was on maybe the largest grave site that we could possibly think of, right? Ground Zero was down there every day. So I think a lot about the way we kind of think about ourselves in the modern day and how the youth of today and the way they think about, you know, what's it like to be a teenager in 2020 or 2021. Yeah. I mean, now coming out of, you know, 9/11, they were not born yet or they were just born, but this is right now, today, in COVID, this is their 9/11, right? This is going to impact the way they think about themselves, think about the world, what it's going to mean in a post-COVID world. I mean, personally, once we're through this, I believe that we're mostly going to get back to normal because human nature, if you study human sociology throughout over thousands and thousands of years, people don't change. We're exactly the same. You know, social norms will adjust, but ultimately we're social beings. We're going to want to be back together again. We're going to figure it out. It's just going to happen. People have short memories for better or for worse. And I would sort of want to explore some of those themes about, you know, what do you do with that pent up anxiety? What do you do with that confusion during a COVID time in a post COVID world? What do you do with it? You know, there are psychic scars that'll be within us, whether we know they're there or not. They will be enacted upon in one form or another. So I'd probably want to touch on some of that a little bit, although I don't really have any desire to do. I will never write a pandemic novel because I just don't have any interest in that kind of thing. You know, people are telling me now, oh, I just watched Contagion. I'm like, why? I don't want to read it. I don't want to write it. I don't want to read it. I don't want to watch it. I'm living it. You know,
One of the author, New York Times author Peter May wrote Lockdown, and it's coming out in August, and it's about the pandemic, and I'm getting it. They said they need me to read it. So I will chance it. You know what I noticed, though, and then we'll get back to why team protagonists, is that when I walk in the street in the morning wearing a mask like a good girl, I do, and my gloves and whatever else, I feel like I look like a bandit or something, but nobody's talking. In an area, I grew up in the South Bronx where everybody knew everybody. Then I lived in the Bronx, and then when I moved up here, it's different. But when I walk into a store, nobody says good morning. Nobody says hello. You walk in the street, the same people that, it's so sad, nobody says anything. It's too quiet. So I'll walk into Rite Aid, and I'll see my favorite cashier, and I'll go, Linda, I came to make you smile. The other day when I walked in, I do that because, you know what, people need to know that it's okay to say hello. Yeah. And I walked in the other day to get a mirror and something else, and all of the representatives, all the cashiers came over. They stood 6 feet away, but they all came over to say hi. And that made me feel so special. And I said, just understand that I did my hair myself, so don't laugh.
I just buzzed my head yesterday. Took the razor. I put it right down to my scalp.
No, I have spiked hair, but I have streaks, and I have red, green, purple, whatever, so I bought some to some in. And they had the gall to tell me I look wonderful. So we have team protagonists, but and like you said before, most of the stories are told not in modern day. So and you told how the cover came out. So I'm going to go to the ones that are in bold on my paper, which is over here. I hope I have the right one. Trust me. The boy Isaac. So what happens when the police investigate what happened, and why did they buy his story? Why did they buy the story?
All right, so just,
we don't
just
want to give
for a reference.
Yeah.
Yeah, but for those who are listening, so.
Yeah.
So Isaac, the paper boy, he's 14 years old or so, and he's out delivering his route, and he witnesses what he believes anyway is one of his customers is murdered in her house. And at first, he's not even sure if he believes it himself, but he freaks out, and he sees some footsteps coming in the house, and he thinks, oh, my God, I just saw my this older woman who is a little bit of a cheapskate, who is actually based on a real customer, a former customer, by the way. And he flips out, and, you know, he's panicking. He doesn't not sure what to do. Ultimately, however, he decides that, you know what, I've got to go to the police. I've got to tell them what happened. Well, you know, you got to remember this. If you go back to 1985, and I actually I consulted with a couple of police officers that I know, and I asked them what would happen, what's realistic, what's not, because I wasn't looking to write some sort of something that's fantastic just to serve the story. I wanted it to seem real. And the thing is that if some kid walks in and says, oh, I saw a murder, you know, you say murder, they're going to listen, but just because you say it doesn't mean it's true. So they listen to him and they hear his story, but they know, they remember that Isaac had a family tragedy years before. And this kid sort of has lost his way. His family's kind of been broken up as a result of this past family tragedy, and there's just not a lot of hard evidence to support what he's saying. They do send a squad car by the house just to sort of check it out, just to kind of do their due diligence. They don't see anything. They don't see any issues. And they don't really believe the kid at first anyway, because there's no reports of a missing body. The woman who supposedly is dead is away on vacation. She's already told people that she was going on this cross-country trip, so the fact that she's not even home, nobody really takes it seriously. And when the cops go by the house and they don't see any evidence of foul play, they said, it's just a kid looking for some attention, and they kind of let it go. At least to start. Isaac, however, in his mind, he knows it's real, or he believes it's real, and says, you know what, I'm going to go deal with this. Now, I'm not saying it was a good idea, but he decides to go and he decides to investigate it himself. He also has, to kill time, he envisions that he plays this game. He's a secret private eye. He's like a James Bond in training, right? He's got this dirt bike with the milk crate fastened to the front for his newspapers, but in his mind it's tricked out, right? It's got laser beams and rocket launchers and all kinds of things. And by the way, I actually did that as a kid because I was bored.
Oh God.
You're by yourself a lot when you're a paperboy because you just got time to kill. So your mind wanders. And this was the time I was watching all James Bond movies, and it's wish fulfillment. Mm-hmm. What kid doesn't want to seem like, you know, you're a superhero or an astronaut or a spy or something like that, you know? So I played all these fantastical games, and that's kind of how that informs Isaac. So he's kind of got this sort of sense of course he's not a real spy, but you fantasize enough and you put all these various components together, and he has this need, this driving need inside of him to sort of write what he believes are some tragic missteps that he made years ago, and he thinks that he needs to sort of he owes it to somebody to make up for some mistakes that he made in the past. And as a result of, you know, like so many teenagers who feel like nobody listens to me, nobody understands me, my parents don't get me, my teachers don't get me, the cops don't get me. I mean, the flip side of it is that, and you know, being a teacher, it's this weird tug of they don't get me. At the same time, I don't want them to get me, right? So I don't let you know me, but then I blame you for not knowing me, because people are just weird that way, right? It's sort of I'm a kid, but I want to be my own person, and you struggle with how to become independent. and he's making some very dangerous choices to sort of enact those unfulfilled fears, desires, fantasies.
Do you want to tell us about, before I ask the next question on my paper, about any of the other characters in your story that you would like to share?
So Isaac has this friend, Danny.
Yeah, I like her. She's so sweet.
She's a great kid. You know, it's one of those kind of very, it's very chaste and very sweet. You know, they're 14, so they're best friends, but obviously they have this real brimming chemistry, and it's awkward because they don't know what to do. You know, you're at 14, you know, your feelings are, look, feelings are confusing at any age. But as a teenager, you're all over the place, right? You don't know. You're partly becoming more of an adult. You probably have one foot in adulthood, one foot in back in your childhood, and you know the ideas of having sexual feelings for someone else are very confusing. They're embarrassing. You don't want to admit it, but your hormones are raging, and you're very confused. And you know, she's my friend, but do I want her to be my girlfriend? You know, even just the thought of like holding someone's hand is this. Forget about even sex at that age. Just having fingertips touch fingertips is this like scary, exciting, magical threshold. And he's not sure what he should do. And she very clearly is trying to push him in that direction, but he's feeling awkward, and she's feeling awkward about the fact that he feels awkward. They kind of start to come together, and ultimately he kind of brings her into the fold. But she's a little bit more, you know, at first it seems more like a game to her, but then when it starts to get a little bit more serious, she is the one saying, Isaac, this is crazy. You can't be doing this. If there's a real actual murderer living, and just to back up, you know, there's this man who is in the murder victim's house who claims, he's like, oh, I'm her brother. I'm just house-sitting for her while she's away. Now, is it real? Well, how do you know? If someone tells you this is who I am, does that mean it's true? I don't know. Does that mean it's false? You know, I don't know. How do you ever really know about somebody? You can either choose to take them at their word, or you could choose not to. And if you take them at their word, it doesn't mean you're right. And if you don't take them at your word, it doesn't mean you're wrong. You can't really know. And she's saying, Isaac, if in fact, let's just pretend he actually did kill her, you can't be going back there. This is crazy. Let the police do their job. And if the police decide, for whatever their reasons, not to investigate, it's not your place to be doing this. You're not a cop. You're not a cop. You're not a spy. She says at one point, you're just a paperboy. What are you doing? So there's this real rift between them, which further confuses him, which in the end almost propels him to sort of say, I'm going to prove myself, right? It's in its own way, it's sort of, I'm going to show you that I'm really a man, right? I mean, he doesn't say that in the book, but the subtext is there. Right, I'm gonna show you all that I'm more than you think that I am.
A lot of kids are like that. But before I forget, I don't want to forget. Next Tuesday, the 28th, Dirty Old Town, Gabriel Vajon. On the 30th, the author of Venomous Love, and on the 5th, one of my favorite people in the whole world, R.G. Belsky, The Last Scoop. On the 7th, the author of Diver's Paradise, and on the 12th, Reese Hirsch. You know what? Yeah, I read all of these, and I got in trouble for Diver's Paradise. Somebody put the thing on the thing, and I said, well, why don't you send it to me to read? So that's how I got that. And
yeah,
I'm
friends with Dick Belsky.
Yeah, Dick was on my show yesterday. We did a panel show on outrageous characters and crazy plots. We do these things. We do a lot of crazy things. Then we have Reese Hirsch with Dark Tomorrow. We have Minister Sam. We're going to talk about soul caring and healing care. And on the 19th, we're going to talk with Pastor Michael Jones about how to deal with stress during this pandemic. And on the 26th, one of my favorite people in the universe, too, John Land, Murder of 12. And what better way to end the month than once again with R.G. Belsky, Tom Walsh, Bruce Coffin, and Charles Soldberg? How do you create your killer and the way he kills people?
He's a friend of mine as well.
I do crazy things like that. It's fun. Yes. And a lot of times I get in trouble when I see somebody advertise two things yesterday, and I said, so how come I don't have that memoir? Well, the author's sending it to me today. Let's get in trouble all the time. It depends on what I see. So when faced with the truth, how does the killer act towards Isaac when he comes face to face with him? I was worried about Isaac at that point.
I'll talk about it, but I don't want to give too much away.
That was one of the bolded questions, so you can just a little bit,
So they have a little bit of a cat and mouse relationship,
mm-hmm.
where, you know, Isaac sort of, he comes to the house and this gentleman says, look, I'm Ms. Gagne's brother, I'm house sitting, and Isaac, he doesn't know kind of really what to believe. He's sort of, at first he's freaked out that there's even someone there, and on the surface, the story seems credible. But he's got real doubt because he knows what he saw, or at minimum, Isaac believes he knows what he saw. Because as we all know, you know, our minds play tricks on us. You know, sometimes it's just, you know, you see a shadow and you're convinced it's a real thing, and then it turns out it's really just a shadow. You know, as they say, you know, sometimes a cigar is just a cigar, but sometimes it's not. So this element of doubt is deep within Isaac about this guy. And look, remember, he's only 14 years old. And when you're 14, if an adult, you know, a 40-year-old man says, this is who I am, and he's very pleasant about it, this is who I am, this is my situation, this is what's happening, part of you is going to say, oh, an authority figure is telling me what's what, and you believe it. Another part of you, especially as a teenager, and depends on what kind of a teenager you are, might immediately think, screw you, you're an adult, because you said it, you are therefore wrong, because it's my sworn duty as a teenager to rebel against everything adult. And sometimes you're somewhere in the middle. And Isaac is somewhere in the middle. He's just not really sure what to do. But because he has these lingering doubts, he decides to do a little reconnaissance. He stakes out the house at night, and he follows this guy around a little bit in a fairly crafty way, I might add, and pretty good at it, because Isaac knows the neighborhood. He's a paper boy. He's worked the street for years. He knows every twig on every bush. He knows every mailbox, every corner. He knows every shortcut. He knows every backyard. And he starts to use this real-world, you know, street-level information to sort of do recon. And he learns some things that propels him to think, you know what, my instincts were right. Now, it doesn't mean he's right, but he becomes convinced that he's right. And as a result, he escalates things to a level that get increasingly dangerous.
Yeah, I know. The reason I like him the best is because he's like me. Now I have to admit it. When I want to know something, it drives my husband crazy. I will get the answers no matter how many phone calls I have to make or who I have to badger to get the answer. So, and it's not, I'm not proving anything. I just want to know what I want to know. And you can ask every healthcare agency in the world when I want to know something from my mom. I go, trust me. I got it done after being, you know, going through whatever. So the police plays a part in Red Ink. What makes them believe Isaac? What makes them finally realize this kid's onto something without saying what he's on?
So Isaac comes into the station with Danny, and he tells them his tale. And, you know, like I said, they kind of don't believe, you know, they're going to take him seriously at first. They're going to listen to him, because if some kid comes into a police station in the middle of the day and says, I know about a murder, well, at minimum, you're going to listen. It doesn't mean you're going to believe it, but you're going to listen. They listen, they hear a story, and ultimately, like I said, they kind of dismiss him. but it lingers a little bit in one of the detective's minds. And he's working on another case that he's been on for a long time that's important to him. And that case kind of goes south. And it just kind of sets off the detective. He just feels so frustrated that this other case went wrong. He feels like, I got to go. I need to I want to affect some change because I can't stand that the system failed me. So he says, that's it. You know what? We're going to take another run at this paperboy thing. I can't. There's something about it. It's just, it's a gut feeling. I can't let it go. We're gonna go poke around ourselves. We're not going to rely on just a drive-by. We're going to go knock on this guy's door and interview this guy ourselves and see if he's really for real. And he and his partner go, and they're left with some doubts.
That's true. And we're not going to tell him any more about it.
Nope.
So Isaac felt he could solve whatever. If Isaac could speak to everybody, what would he tell them from what he learned? What would he tell people? if he could speak to people and say, you know, I did this, I did that, did I do the right thing? What would Isaac say? I'm sorry that the other authors aren't here to tell me what they would say, but I think Natalie would say, I'm possessed by Satan and it's too bad.
Yes. Isaac, I think, would say if he, knowing what he learns by the time the story is over, if he could go back to the beginning, mm-hmm. I think he would say, if you know you're right, don't let go. Don't let the adults convince you that you're wrong. If you know, fight for what you believe in until you get them to come around. Don't let them dismiss you because you're quote unquote just a kid. Just because you're a teenager doesn't make you wrong. It doesn't make your perceptions wrong. It doesn't mean that you should be dismissed out of hand. You know, adults can look. Sometimes we're right and sometimes we're wrong. But if you know you're right, don't let go. Force them to take you seriously.
I agree. Well, I just got an email from someone, text message. I have to announce this because I don't know why they did this, whatever. On Tuesday the 28th at 4 o'clock, R.G. Belsky and guess who? Me, Fran Lewis, with a guest on A Good Story is a Good Story with Marcia Casper Cook. She just told me I'm on the show as one of the people being interviewed. How do you like that? And we're going to talk about writing and working during the pandemic or whatever comes up that we want to talk about. So if you guys want to listen, yeah, that's going to be me with R.G. Belsky. That's what she said. So it should be interesting.
Cool.
I have no idea. So as a result also, the parents in this book, how would you describe them? Were they good role models? I mean, the parents of these kids. Do they realize what was happening?
So in all three stories, you have different layers of sort of detached relationships with the parents and the kids. And look, being a child of the 80s, so first of all, I was a child of multiple divorces. I was a latchkey kid. I mean, today, if you had a latchkey kid, you know, social services would come and take you away. But back then, that was just normal, right? If you were 12 years old and you were left on your own, that was just how it was. Your parents had to work. But when you're on your own like that, you have room to explore. You know, now, I mean, I have two kids. I have 9-year-old twins. And I can't even fathom letting my kids, you know, have the freedom that I had as a child. I survived. I'm fine. But it's just, you know, you're scared because the world is different. You know, these parents were, some of them, honestly, in The Devil's Delinquents, some of the parents were actually good parents and just sort of took their kids' word for what they said. Some of them were completely, they were self-absorbed in their own problems. The Devil's Delinquents and in A Splendid Thing, and even in Red Ink, you know, a lot of the parents were dealing with their own crises. And if you think, so I'm almost 50, but if in these stories, even the parents were probably, you know, 40, right? Because you got married younger, you had kids when you're younger, you know. You're still a human being, and being a parent is very difficult, and it's exhausting, and it's confusing. And back then, in particular, it was more normal to just say, "All right, be home for dinner." That was just how it was. You weren't a strange parent if you did that. Every parent, almost every parent, was like that. Parents didn't know where their kids were. Me and my friends, we were gone. I remember with some of my buddies, we used to sneak in from Long Island. We used to sneak into New York City to buy fireworks when we were like 13 years old. My parents had no idea. They had no clue. We were all over town. I mean, thank God I was not one of those kids who got into trouble, but a lot of kids were. And our parents didn't know where we were, what we did. As long as you came home for dinner and you were not bleeding from both eyes, equilibrium was maintained. It was just normal. So the fact that the parents were kind of, you know, not really on top of what their kids were doing day to day was not so abnormal. You would want to think that they would have a better sense of, wow, there's some bad stuff going on here. But I can tell you, you know, like I said, as a child of divorce. You know, when I was 13, 14, you know, my dad had moved out. So, of course, day to day, he had no idea what I was doing. My mom was raising three kids. She was exhausted. I was doing my own thing. She didn't know what I was up to, and it wasn't that I was doing anything terrible. And it's not that she didn't care. It's hard being a parent. Try being a single parent when you're just struggling to get by. So do I blame the parents? It's a hard thing to know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm very close to both my kids. I have a very strong bond with them. But I don't know what they're doing every second. I don't know what they're thinking every second, what they're feeling every second. You can't really know. So on the one level, you want to think, well, your parents should be there. Where were the parents? On the other side of you is that, how well do you actually know your kid? I mean, you want to think that you do. But do you? Maybe you do. Some do, some don't. It's very difficult. And as I'm sure you know, teenagers are very strong-willed. And, you know, whether it's when they're 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, whatever it is, they just disappear from their parents. That's sort of a normal part of the human growth cycle, right? You sort of have to – you leave your parents so you can come back, right? You have to assert your own independence. And it's common for your parents to have no clue what's going on, even in their own homes. Right.
They didn't live with my mother. My mother knew everything. It was scary. My father had a sense of humor like me, and he would ask me to do something. I had to work in a cleaning store because he worked in a cleaning store. He would ask me to do something, and 5 minutes later, my mother would say, I know what he told you to do. I'd go like, how do you know? She knew everything. It was scary. There was like nothing. I mean, and I had to report in every 5 minutes. It was like if you didn't call in, you were in big trouble. So before we end, we have about 3 minutes.
Okay.
What's next? Where can we find out about everybody's work? And whenever you write it, I need to have it. Seriously, you need to send it to me.
You got it. My next book is I typically write science fiction and fantasy. I'm working on a sci-fi noir. It's private detective, and the book is called Crackle and Fire. It'll be out
on
Crazy 8 Press in September, and I will be very happy to send it to you when it's done. It's although it's science fiction, it's really a private detective book, and it's a lot of fun. I was actually editing pages an hour before this phone call. So that's almost done. Cover's finished. It's very exciting. Sawney Hatton, you can find his books. Sawney and Pat, all of their books are both on Amazon. You can get anything that they do. Pat typically writes a combination of science. He's more like me. He writes a lot of science fiction, fantasy, and some crime. He also writes some children's books. Sawney is, of the three of us, he writes the darkest kind of fiction. He writes a lot of dark fiction. He's got a couple of collections of short stories. Some are more dark, some are more sci-fi horror. Again, you can go to Amazon and find anything almost anything that they have, you can find there quite easily. And it's Sawney Hatton and Patrick Thomas. And I'm Russ Colchinero.
I said your name right. I'm impressed with myself, too.
Yes.
This has been interesting, and thank you a million times. I can't believe we finally got this done. I was like getting what is going to happen next. But this was interesting, and I really hope that we get to do this again. And one question before we go, would the three authors get together ever if I have are my shows booked until August? I don't do anything in July. I take off in July for a reason. And would you guys do a panel show together to talk about the type of subjects that you write about, how you intertwine them, and how they're different in your writing process? That you would do that. So email.
Yeah, absolutely.
That would be interesting. I would probably want to do it in August. That would be great.
They both wanted to be here today. It was just everyone's schedules are disrupted now for obvious reasons, and they just weren't able to make it, but they very much wanted to be here.
Okay, so we'll have to set something up for August that'll come up with something wild and crazy to do, because that's me. Anyway.
That sounds good.
Thank you.
That sounds great.
Everybody, thank you so much. Russ, thank you with that million times. Cheryl, thank you so much for listening. Everybody have a great day, and bye.
All right, take care now.